From coast to coast and worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Indeed, with an evening tonight with legendary teacher John Taylor Gatto. Stay tuned for that one. We'll be back in a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM. John Taylor Gatto completed his undergraduate work at Cornell, the University of Pittsburgh in Columbia. He then served in the U.S. Army Medical Corps at Fort Knox, Kentucky and Fort Sam Houston, Texas. Following his military service, John did graduate work at the City University of New York, Hunter College, Yeshiva, the University of California, and Cornell. After college, he worked as a scriptwriter, an advertising writer, a taxi driver, an ASCAP songwriter, and other assorted jobs before becoming a school teacher. John has been named New York City Teacher of the Year on three occasions. Now, he then quit teaching in 1991 while still the New York State Teacher of the Year, claiming that he was no longer willing to hurt children. Later that year, he was the subject of a show at Carnegie Hall called An Evening with John Taylor Gatto. While launching a career in public speaking in the area of school reform, John is currently at work on a documentary film about the nature of modern schooling entitled The Fourth Purpose with his friend and former student Roland Lee Girardi, Laura, if I got that right, and he also hopes to build a rural retreat and library for the use of families pondering local and personal issues of school reform. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast AM. John, how are you?
Hi, George. Great pleasure to be with you. You're my wife's favorite human being.
Well, that's great. Hey, I hope I didn't butcher your friend's last name too much, huh?
You did a wonderful job on it.
Well, that's because of the teachers I had in school who taught me the right way. You really did quit teaching while you were still the New York State Teacher of the Year?
I quit teaching on the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal. I said I couldn't hurt kids any longer. That was July 15th, 1991, and almost immediately I expected to go and become a garlic farmer. I have a farm upstate that I'm turning into a retreat. I started to get calls. The first one was from the White House, and the second one was from NASA Goddard Space Center, and those calls have continued right up to the moment. I've traveled 2.5 million miles, ten countries, and all 40 are there 50 states.
Now, when you said you don't want to hurt children anymore, what did you mean by that?
The structure of compulsion schooling is set up to create incomplete people. It's the strangest kind of do-gooder phenomenon. That is to say, the people who did this weren't evil. They simply had a terminal disbelief in the potential of most people. They didn't want them to get in the way of efficient management. And so schools were set up to train people in, it's very odd, unproductive ways. And habits and attitudes. The academic patina is window dressing.
You know, John, there's so much I want to talk with you about with schooling and what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong, and also get your take on comparing what we do to some other countries, because it also seems that when we bring in people from other nations, we're bringing in some high-powered thinkers, you know, these doctors and experts in science, and I'm just wondering if we have that kind of pool to pick from here, why we're pulling from there.
Well, we certainly have that kind of pool to pick from. It's simply not in the larger design for, let me call it, efficient management of the globe, not the United States. The people who gave us our schools had given up their belief in nation states 100 years ago. It's very, very clear from their own writing that they think it's a relic of barbarism, but it will have to be maintained until everyone is brought up to speed. Funny you said great thinkers. I just heard a Russian exchange student the other day, and I mean a junior high school exchange student, say in disbelief when she saw the math curriculum, she said, "Is this a joke?" Now, she wasn't editorializing. She was reacting to the difference between what she was familiar with as a perfectly ordinary student and what's offered here to the so-called gifted and talented. If I seem to take some amusement in this over the next 2 hours, I want to apologize to your readers. It's the only way I keep my sanity after,
I understand,
after dealing with this for 45 years and then another 20 years as a student.
Did we do it all wrong as a country in terms of our educational system?
Well, depends on your own philosophy. From one point of view, and I mean the dominant point of view, not the majority point of view, but the dominant point of view, we've done it brilliantly well. That's why our economy is unstoppable, or has been at least, for 100 years. We've turned people into human resources, away from peoplehood into resourcehood, if I can invent some words there. And because they're so tractable and so manageable, we're able to achieve prodigies of production. The price for that, of course, is incomplete, mutilated lives. It's a radical extension of childhood, way, way beyond its historical parameters, so that people, as they prepare for their coffins, are in a large sense still in childhood.
John, as you look at education when you decided to become a teacher, I'm sure you had your favorite students. They had their favorite teacher, and most of them probably would have picked you. I had one with a science teacher back in sixth grade. His name was Mr. Strom. God bless his soul. I don't think he's alive now. And he got me interested in science, and I would build little rockets for science fairs and things like that. Then I had a teacher in high school who taught physics. His name was Mr. Kiefer. Loved him. I was going into the sciences, and I also wanted to go into broadcasting. So I was going in two different directions, and I tried to put them both together. But it's also the teacher, I think, and the parents that have a tremendous influence on us as kids.
Well, of course you're right. And of course, school as an occupation attracts a great many talented, dedicated, decent human beings. The ones that are memorable, I think, across the board, are the ones that unknowingly sabotage the system. They break out of this narrow set of parameters that are imposed, and in doing so, usually they stick their neck out a country mile. Now, I don't want your readers to get the wrong impression. I'm not talking about people who wear beards and headbands. I'm talking about people who love ideas and love to spread the love of ideas. Those people are quite dangerous to the systematic schooling philosophy. Often they're tolerated because they set up a disguise over what's really going on. My daughter used to write me from MIT about people she loved, and I said, be very, very careful. Those people are tolerated in order to set up the misapprehension that if only we had more people like that, then schooling would be okay. The most prominent case of what I'm talking about in recent years was the Peruvian immigrant Jaime Escalante, who went to one of the 20 worst schools statistically in the state of California, and inside of 2 years, he had the top-performing class in advanced calculus in the state of California. Of course, he was hated and despised by the school administration and by a great many of his fellow teachers, and eventually he was driven screaming from the building, but not before a movie was made that I really urge all your listeners to rent. It's called Stand and Deliver.
I've heard of that. I haven't seen that one yet. I haven't seen that one. There was also another one called Stand By Me that Morgan Freeman played the principal in.
Is that the one with the baseball bat?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's a peripheral topic, but I had plenty of occasion over 30 years in the classroom to see that kids had utter contempt for people who tolerated, ugly behavior.
Well, you know, there was another movie of which I cannot remember the title to, John, that somewhere along the line, this guy had escaped from an institution. Now, this was a comedy, by the way. He had escaped from an institution, made his way into a school, and started filling in for a teacher who was sick. But this guy had every student interested in history because he would walk in dressed up like George Washington, and he made all the kids perform.
You're really not joking.
No.
There are people like that sprinkled across the country. There's a famous teacher who wrote a book called The Teacher Who Couldn't Read. The guy became, I think it was in Oregon, he became the Teacher of the Year, but in fact, he couldn't read. He got through college with good grades, and he couldn't read. And he became an English teacher, and he couldn't read. I met him a few years ago at a convention, and we laughed for a long time. But in his book, he explains how you can represent the appearance of a well-read person and pick up cues, you know, and
absolutely
communicate them. It's well, it's a revelation, but Escalante is revolutionary in this sense, George. We're talking about advanced calculus, which this man, who was an overweight, overage Peruvian immigrant, taught to kids who'd never eaten off a tablecloth before.
That's incredible.
Mexican immigrant kids, and inside of 2 years, forget Beverly Hills, it was the top performing calculus class in the state of California, and inside of 3 years in the United States, including private boarding schools, it was the third top performing calculus class.
What happened to him? Why'd they drum him out?
Oh, well, don't you see that the distribution of kids in classes, and they're not called classes by accident, it's an attempt to stabilize the social class system. To do that, you have to have most people content with where they're placed, wherever that is. So what Escalante's performance did with a very, very abstract and high-prestige subject, advanced calculus, was to show that, I don't mean to offend anybody, but the wetback children, you know, Mexican immigrants, could rise to the very top of that intellectual scale in a very short period of time. Do you see the revolutionary message there?
Absolutely.
That we're sitting on probably 60 million kids confined in schooling, and like ourselves, for which it's probably too late, I mean, what we have is a genius that's as common as the air we breathe. It's simply, George, that over the course of human history, no managerial system ever figured out how to operate with people who were too smart or too moral, too competent. So it's necessary to layer these people. I'm not defending what they did. It's a bankruptcy of imagination, but it perpetuates itself from decade to decade, from century to century.
Are you convinced that we are going to get a better education system in the next 10 years, or are we still going down the same path?
Oh, no. We're going down the same path recklessly, much faster than we ever did. That's what No Child Left Behind is. I mean, pray that your child is left behind. The the tools of indoctrination are much more sophisticated than they ever were before, and the school has been tied intimately with the workplace now, so that the penalties for not subordinating yourself and repeating what you're told to repeat can be quite large. Now, I hope in the course of the hours we're together, I can show you that, in fact, the manager's children aren't taught this way, and the people who escape this trap on any level can move very quickly through the system. But if you believe what you're told, if you believe, for example, that standardized tests have any connection with high quality, then you're really lost.
You're right. You're right. I always thought that a good teacher didn't even grade with a test, simply graded by attitude and ability and just the way a student reacted in class.
Oh, you're on to something very, very important. I couldn't have been in classroom teaching for 3 years before I realized that in the first 48 hours that I was with my classes, if I watched them very closely, I could tell almost perfectly who would be the A students, who would be the B students, C, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I say that, I don't mean I could tell who would produce the highest quality work or surprise me in the class with accomplishment. I mean who would get the highest grades. What I eventually concocted, I hope your audience gets a kick out of this, about 20 years into the business, when I realized that the people who scored highest on the reading test actually couldn't read very well, I concocted a reading test, an open book reading test with a very, very simple book, All Quiet on the Western Front, a famous First World War novel, that in the course of 10 years administering it to the top performing kids in the reading class, nobody, not a single kid, was able to pass. It was an open book test with extremely stupid questions asked, no trick questions. What was the secret of them not being able to pass? All right, get ready for this. And those of you out there who are students of the business, get a pencil in hand. The standardized reading test asks about seven or eight different kinds of reading information. But in fact, in a complex piece of reading, there's several hundred different qualities of information. If you addict kids to being rewarded for remembering these seven or eight qualities of information, they will, especially the brighter kids, they will wipe their minds blank of all other kinds of information. They will act as their own prisoners so that they'll be able to read the kind of information that, say, a boss would leave behind and say, do this, this, and this
right,
while I'm down in Bermuda, but they won't be able to penetrate the mind of the author, his intentions, etc., etc. Wow. So all I did was ask for one or another of the 193 missing kinds of information. And in the first couple of years, to my horror, really, when I saw that people couldn't get more than 10 on an exam, and
right,
these are kids who were supposedly reading on a college level, I then, because I wasn't out to torment kids, I changed it to an open book test. And All Quiet on the Western Front is written in one-syllable words.
Stay with us, John. We're going to take this quick break. We're going to come right back with you and pick up where we left off. A little bit later on tonight, I also want to talk with you about Darwinism versus creationism. And, of course, that movie with Morgan Freeman was called Lean on Me. And the other one with the guy who escaped from the institution and becomes a substitute teacher, everyone is telling me via Fast Blast that it's teachers. I think that was what it was. I'll be back in a moment with John Taylor Gatto right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with John Taylor Gatto, our guest. John, let's get back to what you were talking about in terms of how you kind of changed the testing a little bit to find out why people were or were not responding.
Well, in the case of the people who were rewarded by the standardized testing system, I had independently ascertained that they couldn't read very well. And it really baffled me. So I thought about it and thought about it. I mean, for several years. And finally it occurred to me that the way the questions were asked on the standardized test repeated a request for a very narrow number of categories of information. And I knew that from being a student of the language that there were several hundred categories of information. So that I said, what if I ask these kids from these different types of information? How would they do? And I took a simple book, All Quiet on the Western Front, although an excellent, excellent book, but written in one and two syllable words. And I first presented these tests the way tests are usually presented. So you had to remember. But when I would get the best scores being 10 or 20 on that, I felt like I'd been unfair. So I said, what if I give them an open book test? And the results were almost the same. They were slightly better, marginally better, but nobody in 10 years of doing this ever passed the test. So I was really able to open the kids' eyes to how they had been conditioned not to read, even though they appeared to be reading well.
See, that was the results of, you did your own private test, basically, and you found out that the conditioning was the reason why they couldn't get good scores, no matter what they tried to do.
Oh, yeah. Well, look, all of us have noticed that the span of attention among teenagers is very short. It's hard to get a teenage kid to concentrate on anything. If I told you that that is a deliberately conditioned phenomenon by the normal attributes of a day in school, I mean, I could specify those attributes as well. Of course, it would seem like I was talking about some phenomenal conspiracy. Well, I would say this to your listeners. When you eat chicken or beef, do you feel that you're conspiring against those lower life forms? I don't think so. And similarly, the people who organized this system believed that there was a danger to human progress if ordinary people were allowed to develop independent consciousness, and especially according to Darwin, that's the same Charles Darwin who's in every high school textbook in the country. Mm-hmm. According to Darwin, the book is in question is Descent of Man, published in the United States in 1871. Darwin said that if the bad breeding stock, which he estimated to be 95% of the population, crossbred with the good stuff, that evolution would march backwards. George, I'm not making this up. And if anyone listening to your show is Irish, Darwin used the Irish as an example of an entire race, he called them, that was bad breeding stock. Now that, I know, isn't mentioned in any high school textbook, but go to Descent of Man and you'll see information about the Irish that you'll burst into laughter, unless you're Irish, of course.
That's right. My Boston audience is going crazy right now, probably.
Oh, my. Well, I for those of you who came to the show late, I'm apologizing for being merry about this. After dealing with this for the last 20 years, it's the only way I can keep my sanity.
Well, but, you know, John, if you were to tell a kid today, just go up to him and say, what's 46 minus 13? I don't think he could give you the answer without a calculator.
Oh, my. Yes, and it's much worse than that. I was speaking to a teacher the other day, an English teacher, who said she hadn't had a single student for years who could write a focused essay of analysis. She was talking offhandedly about Pinochet's Nazi-style regime in Chile, in the 70s and 80s. Not a single person in any of her classes knew where Chile was. Not a single one in any of her classes knew what socialism or fascism was. Nobody knew. She made analogies to Plato's Allegory of the Cave. Not a single person recognized that. And it was impossible, she said, for any of them to understand the theme of the novel that she was having them read in class without a basic knowledge of Plato's work, which the novel had been derived from. No one in the class or any of her classes had ever heard of the CIA-sponsored coup that terminated Chile's democracy. It's fascinating. We have wiped the slate clean for most of our kids and replaced it with nonsense garbage or disconnected facts. I have a wonderful piece of evidence to present to your audience. Somewhere around the year 1900, that's a long time ago, a century and more, Cambridge University, certainly one of the most prestigious universities in the history of the human race, forbade short answer tests to be used. And they've continued that ever since. You can't get a degree at Cambridge without first announcing to the faculty what quality degree you want, which is either first class, second class, third class, or ordinary. Can you imagine somebody saying, I want an ordinary
yeah, I
degree.
Just want an ordinary degree, please.
And then, how do you get that degree? You have to write a long essay that's either first class, second class, third class, or ordinary. Oxford held out for about a decade, and then they were compelled by the obvious rightness of the Cambridge thing to adopt pretty much the same system. The idea is that 100 years ago and more, the Cambridge dons understood that if you fill people's minds with disconnected facts, you've in fact destroyed their ability to think in context. They can memorize the facts you want them to memorize, but they can't think clearly about, you know, the hows and whys of things, the connections between things, so that these mass inoculations of short answer tests are just a fabulous way to remove the mind,
yeah,
the intellect from ordinary people. And when I say ordinary people, I don't mean that in any pejorative sense. People are made ordinary by their imagination, by their enterprise, by their opportunities. My experience and Jaime Escalante's experience was that virtually nobody is ordinary. That a wetback kid can go to the top of the advanced calculus scale inside of a year. That's why Escalante had to be driven out of the business. And that's why the movie about him ducks what he actually did. I mean, they make him the standard kind of heroic teacher. You know, I mean, we've seen that movie 100 times, every one of us.
They couldn't take it, could they?
They couldn't take the reality of it because it calls into question all theories of management. It calls into question Darwin's idea that 95% of the human race is biological trash. It calls into question the Prussian system that we borrowed for the American schooling system, which assumes that people are rigidly layered into different quality personalities, minds, characters there. It isn't true. 30 years in the classroom, mind you, I come from quite a conservative background, and I went to two Ivy League colleges that indoctrinated me in how stupid most people are. But the evidence of my eyes and ears in the classroom was so contradictory to what I had been taught, not by my family, who were very egalitarian, but certainly by the formal education I had. I should have not seen the miracles that were being produced on a regular basis by perfectly ordinary kids who were supposed to be C and D students.
So what do you blame the most, John, the system or the teacher? Because I think both are important to a student.
I think what we have to understand is that it's not an accident that we speak of the school system in a systematic form of schooling. A teacher's like a relay meant to convey the orders from you know, the higher authority. And those teachers, all of them, are measured by how purely they transmit what they're asked to transmit. All the rest of that stuff that makes great teachers that we all have recognized as students is irregular. The system is meant to produce a perfectly manageable population, and we've got to face this, George, that in a corporate economy, that leads to immense rivers of wealth. Of course, the price is that you mutilate most of your population. Nevertheless, if material is what you're after, Lord knows this is the way to do it.
Question about it, John. When you look at teachers, do they all get paid in certain groups, don't they? How come they don't get paid as individuals? You know, like, you're a good teacher, you should cut your own deal.
Because what a parent or a kid thinks of as good, or maybe just the general innocent public who doesn't think much about schools, and rightly so, but good in systematic terms. Think of it. If someone was good enough to stand out from the rest, by definition, they're asystematic. They're a danger to the stability of the system, and they have to be eliminated or brought back to earth one way or another. The only exceptions to that in teaching are, A, the class of saboteurs, of which I was one, who usually identify themselves as saboteurs, so their tenure is very short, or there's a certain number of teachers who are encapsulated. They're insulated and allowed to be better than the average as long as they're kept apart from the rest of the faculty, and their lessons are kept apart from most of the students. That's not hard to do. All you have to do is award a teacher special favors, petty stuff, like a parking permit or a room on the shady side of the building instead of the sunny side of the building, and what you have is somebody who will be ostracized by the rest of the faculty.
Now, I want you to point something out, by the way, from a couple messages I'm getting from some people who have totally misunderstood what you were saying about Hispanic kids when you used the phrase wetbacks. That wasn't coming from you. That was how that school system theoretically thought of them. Because,
oh, correct.
Yes, all right.
No, absolutely. In fact, my message about the people that I passed that offensive term wetback is that someone knowledgeable about what they were capable of could raise them to the pinnacle of advanced calculus in 1 year. Think of the threat to the whole math teaching system in the whole United States if we allowed that to be widely understood. That's what the Russian girl meant when she looked at our math curriculum and said, is this a joke?
Correct. Okay, good. I'm glad you pointed that out.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I worked for, I'd say, half of my 30-year teaching career. I worked with kids who certainly were massively disadvantaged from either Black Harlem or Spanish Harlem, and my lessons about the universality of human genius are largely drawn from those kids who had already been disqualified.
You see, though, how some people, and not a lot, believe me, but how some people just don't listen.
Oh, well, I would say a lot. They don't listen and they don't read because they're trained that way in school. That's on purpose in order to make the management system efficient. Look, if you can't listen and if you can't read, you are permanently out of the loop where having an independent livelihood is concerned. And as long as you're an employee, and I mean all the way up through middle management, you're no danger to anybody. You know, and this is the way we keep people in their place, by removing the intellectual tools, also by removing the moral tools. I'll tell you the most revolutionary thing that you can teach 12 and 13-year-old kids who are swinging on the chandeliers, you know, et cetera, is that a major way that we select people for privileges isn't their scores on tests. Nobody even looks at those tests. It's simply that they have graceful manners and appear to be civilized. So I used to tell kids, look, I can't make you be that way, but I can tell you that if you don't know how to fake it successfully, that you are going to be persecuted every day of your life, and you'll never get a break unless you win the lottery. There, I said, the greatest thing you can learn right now is how to look like and act like a lady and a gentleman. I said, if you want to be a savage inside, I said, hey, go ahead. I can't do anything about that. But I actually knew that once you've received the good treatment in return that comes when you act in a decorous fashion, you never go back to the other thing.
No, at all. You can't. It's impossible. Hey. John, we're going to take this break. We're coming up on the top of the hour. We've got you for a couple more hours. I want to talk with you a little bit more about this topic we're on right now, and that's the screwed up school systems that we have. And also, I want to get into Darwin and evolution and creationism when we come right back. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Sometime tonight, Jen, I want to talk with you about Darwin and creationism, but also tell us a little bit about the book Dumbing Us Down that you've written. You're offering a special deal for Coast to Coast AM listeners, and I wanted to get that out right now.
Oh, good. What I'm offering is a very special deal on my latest book. That's The Underground History of American Education. It took 10 years to write, and it's as long as three long books. It's 335,000 words, so you can throw it at rats if if you get angry at it. Anyway, it's a big book, and it's packed full of facts and the documentation of those facts. And we've just raised the price to $35, but if you'll mention Coast to Coast when you order it, I'll do two things. One, that you can have the old price of $30 on Underground History of American Education, and I'll include a cassette of one of my most popular lectures on the scientific management of children. We charge $8 and $10 for this cassette, but if you'll mention, you've got to mention Coast to Coast because this is not a generic offer.
Right.
If you mention Coast to Coast, you'll get the $8 or $10 cassette, and you'll also get $5 off the book. Now, you
and
order
the cassette's free, you're saying, right?
The cassette will be absolutely free.
Okay.
So if you have a computer, you order at 212.
Hold on.
You order at my website, right, which is www.johntaylorgatto.com. I'm going to spell Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R, and Gatto is G-A-T-T-O. That's www.johntaylorgatto.com. And remember to mention Coast to Coast, because no one else gets this deal. Now, if you don't use the Internet, you can fax the order to 212-529-3555, and you only have to include five pieces of information: a credit card number, your name, your address, your telephone number, and the expiration date on the credit card. That's five pieces of information. And for those of you who don't like or don't use the Internet for whatever reason, it's 212-529-3555. I have a third offer, again, only to Coast to Coast listeners. I speak all over the world and all over the country, and I'll offer $500 off my speaking fee if anybody out there has an organization that would like to hear from me in person. I have to warn you that from January through March, I'm touring Europe on a speaking tour, so I wouldn't be available until April, May, June, and on through the rest of the year. But you can ask for that on the website or through the fax if that interests.
Great, and we'll get all this information out next hour as well, John, okay?
Thank you, George.
You get a lot of speaking engagements abroad, don't you? Why? Why do they tap into an American teacher for
it's
this?
It's amazing. It really is amazing, and once again, my merriment is because I'm partly baffled, but I have a hypothesis. For example, I've spoken for the Chinese government in Beijing several times. I've spoken for the Singapore government three times. Down in Colombia and South America, I've spoken for the government. In almost every case, I have to sign a paper saying that I won't tell anybody, so I apologize for having broken that silence. However, there's such a repetition of similarity in my encounters that here's what I think it is, that all of these countries have adopted a U.S. style of schooling, and some of them are pushing it very, very hard. As a consequence, they're getting the same kind of pathological behavior as we're very familiar with all over the United States from school kids. In Singapore, for example, the family unit's breaking down. And why not? School is resolutely anti-family. And you can see that the reason's purely political. I mean, it's other things, too. But political's enough that you can't have a secondary source of authority and have any efficiency in indoctrinating kids. That's why schools are anti-religion as well. There are other reasons, but you can simplify the contents of your mind by simply saying they can't allow an alternative source of wisdom to influence the kids, so they have to run down these other sources of authority. I believe that it's because I'm telling the factual truth, and nobody, and I mean nobody, around the country or the world, including school administrators, can get this information without putting themselves in jeopardy, even asking these questions. So also, I made ghetto classes work very well, and we hear all the time that we need lots more money and attention and love to make them work. Well, those are nice things. We don't need those things to make them work. We have to understand the difference between an education and a schooling. And kids are desperate to get an education, although they may not be able to articulate that in words. And they despise a schooling because they understand instinctively what it is. Let me tell you, an 11-year-old boy, the son of two Taiwanese immigrants from the West Coast, told me what school was about. And do we have a moment,
yeah,
George?
Yeah, sure do. 11 years old, you're saying.
11 years old and not even born in this country. He said, it's the trapped flea principle.
Now, what did he mean by that?
I said, what? What do you mean? He said, this kid was scientifically oriented. He said, when you put fleas in a shallow dish, they'll jump out. But if you put a lid on the shallow dish, when they try to jump out, they'll hit their heads over and over and hurt their heads. So when you take the lid off, they won't ever try to jump out of the dish again. I almost fainted as an 11-year-old boy. His name's Andrew Sue, T-S-U, to give him credit for that brilliant idea.
How true. You know, when people say, we can't move into this town, they have a lousy school system, what do they mean? I mean, are the teachers all bad? Are the buildings decrepit?
Well, a lot of it's a social class thing. I mean, a lot of it's, observation of riotous behavior and a little bit of its examination of the texts and the teachers and the physical plan. But the truth is that there's virtually, that's a virtually universal pronouncement. Do not be fooled by a quiet, attractive interior and smiling teachers.
Good point.
Every state in the union is under the direction of the higher levels of the system. I don't want to sound conspiratorial. You can track these things easily to their sources.
You could build a brand new school with state-of-the-art equipment, and it could be lousy for education.
Oh, God bless, George, of course. If it isn't lousy for education, I can tell you there will be federal inspectors come around, and there'll be people come around from different authority groupings, and they will make it very, very hot for you, including from the local political clubs, who get the main source of patronage they have to distribute from systematic schooling.
Take this back a little bit, too. Though we're concerned about our kids in school and the way they're being educated and taught, what about our teachers who are going to college to get educated so they can teach?
Of course. The colleges not only are in this thing over their necks, but the colleges derive 30% of their total income, coast to coast, from teaching courses that provide teacher credits for certification. They're not allowed. You can see. Now, allowed, I don't mean someone comes around and says you're not allowed to do this. You just pick that up immediately. I, in fact, taught in a prominent New York university for 5 years, and I was the highest-rated member of the education department, and it had 164 people in it, and that's pretty big. Let me tell you that I did not get tenure. I didn't get tenure because my kids operated in a vastly different fashion than the other class kids did. And I was considered a danger to the school, even though I had no interest in waving my fist in the air, throwing mud at buildings. I just showed them how to liberate the educational passion of kids. It isn't even very difficult to do, but it's almost impossible to do inside the structure of systematic schooling unless you have a principal and a superintendent who are themselves saboteurs. But that is so scarce that don't count on that.
Well, John, you've hit it on the head. And one thing, when you were named the New York State Teacher of the Year, in your opinion, why did you get that? What were you so good at?
Well, you know, what's really fascinating, George, is that there were 38 judges, and a large number of us appeared and presented our credentials before this 38-member panel, each member representing some power interest in New York State. Not one of them thought to ask me how I got these effects. The record my kids ran up was just astonishing. It's still, it's still today, 20 years later, it's an astonishing record. But anybody could have done it, George. So I'm not patting myself on the back. They didn't ask me how it was done. And, of course, I did it by breaking the law flagrantly. I never violated the trust of parents. I always would go to the parents' homes every year, and we would talk over strategies for liberating this individual kid or that individual kid. And as a consequence, my kids were always in the newspapers, on television. They started businesses that made tens of thousands. These are 13-year-old kids, you know. And before you say, well, you know, he's a rare teacher like Jaime Escalante, that's nonsense. Pick up a 100-page book, The Autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, and you will see how Franklin educated himself at the age of 12 and 13 hundreds of years ago. I said, well, if Franklin can do it, I mean, I read that in college, I guess a lot of you have. I read it. I didn't read the words and pass the test on it. I read it. And here this guy is putting himself through an education at the age of 12 in colonial Philadelphia that I guarantee you no Harvard, Yale, or Princeton freshman or sophomore would dare to tackle today, probably not through the whole college career.
Right.
And yet it doesn't cost a penny.
Is it still appropriate now?
Oh, it's absolutely appropriate. The elite private boarding schools of the United States, there are only about 300 of these places, and there are really only 20 of them that count. I'm sorry, I don't want to break your heart if your kid's going to one of the...
And what do the parents pay for something like that, John?
Well, the funny thing is they pay a fortune. But, George, what these schools do doesn't cost a penny. Half of my secret was simply adapting these principles of elite private education to a public school classroom in Spanish Harlem. And after, I'm not going to say it works instantly, because first you got to get the kids to trust you. Every
right.
teacher says, this class is going to be different. None of them are. But once they see that they're going to have the opportunity for an education, and remember, they wouldn't put it in those words, they will lend themselves enthusiastically to exactly the same kind of education that Grotner, Andover, or Hotchkiss produces.
That are costing thousands and thousands of dollars.
Yeah, well, let me give you a few specifics so this isn't just rhetoric. And if you get the book, you'll find this in detail and much, much more than we have time for tonight. All of these schools aim for a strong competency in the active literacies. Now, notice that term has completely vanished from the public imagination. And yet 100 or 200 years ago, it was very common. In colonial America, it was against the law to teach ordinary people the active literacy. So what are they?
It was against the law? Really?
It was against the law. In Virginia, it was a serious crime, that in British Virginia, a serious crime to teach ordinary people the active literacies. But in fact, it was discouraged everywhere. So what are the active literacies? Well, think of it this way. No matter how well you read and how highly developed your mind becomes, if you can't communicate well enough to recruit allies, you're no danger to anybody. The active literacies are public speaking and writing, and without those, you have a narrowly circumscribed life, regardless of what field you enter, including the sciences.
So true. And now with television, John, if you are a good public speaker, and let's equate that to a politician, the chances are he's going to get the lion's share of the votes now.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I made television a central part. I said, ignore the text, the substance of what anyone's saying. Watch how they say it, and you will get a first-class rhetorical training for nothing at all. Watch how they accent things. There's not ever a flat reading. Nobody survives on television or in radio who doesn't accent words in a dynamic way. You can figure this out. I mean, kids learn this in 2 or 3 days, and they go from being, klutzes and nerds to being pretty darn effective speakers.
I had a speech teacher, John, in the University of Detroit. His name was Henry Schneiderman. What a wonderful guy he was. And he said, hey, George, read this. So my first reading was, the man went down the road. And he came up to me in front of the class and said, you want to go into broadcasting, you want to be the best at what you're doing, and you read like that? And I said, well, what was wrong with it? And he went, watch me. And he went, the man went down the road. And he said that one word in that sentence changes the whole perception of what you did.
Sure.
And I learned from what he did.
It's sort of like riding a bicycle, a two-wheeler. Until you can do that, I mean, it seems fraught with danger and something only the big kids can do. But the instant you keep your balance going down a hill, you never fall off again, unless you're nuts. Similarly, what my kids would do, and remember, to a large extent, these were ghetto kids. Not exclusively. Also had the sons and daughters, some very wealthy people. But these ghetto kids would sweep the boards in public school and in writing competitions. Let me tell you.
I know. You pulled some miracles, John. Hey, we got to take this break. But let me tell you something. Now I know why you've been named the New York City Teacher of the Year on 3 separate occasions. We should have you as the head of, Department of Education, quite frankly. You need a cabinet position. We'll be back with John Taylor Gatto in just a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM. We'll chat a little bit about the creationism and Darwinism, get his thoughts on what the schools are doing with that in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, John, before we get into Darwinism versus creationism, get your thoughts on that. In all your history of teaching, was there that one student that came in a disaster and left where you were just so proud of him or her?
Oh, absolutely. I would say there was hardly a year when that didn't happen. Once you connect a kid with his or her own power, and I'm not suggesting that's easy to do, but it isn't so hard to do that I don't think everybody has a fighting chance at that. Once you connect them with their own power, they don't want their time wasted. And they understand that they have this narrow window where they're free to explore and to learn how to use their minds, and then they're going to be in the pressure cooker. It's just a fabulous thing to see. I would tell my wife, I only taught, I don't know if I should say this, but I will. I taught originally on a borrowed teaching license. New York didn't require a photograph.
Uh-huh.
And so in between advertising jobs, where I intended to get rich, I wrote TV commercials, in between ad jobs, I borrowed a teaching license and started to teach. I became so intrigued by the tremendously exciting responsibility that you get. You know, most jobs don't give you any real responsibility. You do your trick, and then you go get drunk. So I would say to my wife, I can't wait to get in there in the morning to find out what these kids are going to teach me. It was like having 120 extensions onto my own mind. It was really is a thrilling thing to do. I mean, it's very depressing also if you don't have a fighting spirit.
Absolutely. It could break you down.
Oh, the system will break you down. And the kids will break you down as long as you do the system's work, because you're actually mutilating them. You don't mean to, but you are.
They hate the system, don't they?
Well, just take the idea of uninterrupted time. It's one of the great privileges and pleasures of anybody's life, but one of the principal weapons of mass instruction employed by compulsion schools is the destruction of uninterrupted time. Schools are rat maze of activity: bells, loudspeaker interruptions, unannounced messengers or visitors, toilet interruptions, going and coming, distractions by unruly kids and from the street outside. And the effect of losing unbroken time is absolutely enormous. Just enormous.
That's it. You are right. It is.
I mean, without it, there have been, I hate to cite scientific tests, because the ones that come from university laboratories are mostly faked in order to keep the work. But there have been such a wealth of these investigations into what happens if you interrupt somebody's attention often enough. It turns out eventually that the people can't synthesize the information they take in. And if the bells and the knocks and the disembodied loudspeaker voices and the flatulence imitating sounds impinge on your concentration often enough, and I don't see how you could avoid that, it becomes hard to make sense of anything, even if the distractions are brief. Remember from history that it only took one knock on his door to make Samuel Coleridge forget what he had planned for the second half of his famous poem, Kubla Khan, so it remains a fragment today. Think of Isaac Newton under a tree figuring out gravity by himself from watching apples fall. Or if you read about how Watson and Crick actually discovered DNA, it's fascinating. They were screwing around cooking things in an oven with a window, not for scientific purposes, but just to, you know, just to take a break from what they were doing, and they saw something that didn't add up. You need this time. And institutional schooling has conditioned parents and a lot of kids into a dread of idleness. Even though if academic results are the measure, these schools actually do very little. It's hurry up and wait, as you say in the army. So that's one of the weapons of mass instruction. There are dozens of them, and once you've adjusted your mind to see this way, to see that this is an engine designed to produce two things: one, to produce customers for the mass production economy, people who are so bored and can't initiate their own lines of meaning that they buy things constantly in order to relieve this feeling of boredom. Mm-hmm. And then in a secondary but still important sense, it's to condition people to work in these huge pods doing one thing over and over again until they drop dead or their teeth fall out.
You are so right on the money, John.
Well, thank you. Thank you, George. I take that as a high call.
Hey, let me take a few moments this hour, what's left of this hour, before phone calls next hour, and that'll be it for you. I've used you for 3 hours then. Darwinism versus creationism.
Yes.
Why is there such a controversy going on?
Oh, well, it's a lovely question, and thank you for asking it. This took me about 6 years to work out down at Dusty Library Stacks. But let's start with a few facts that none of your listeners, or very few, will ever have heard. Darwin's first ambition was to be a minister of the state church of England. And he, in fact, went entirely through a theological school training. What's interesting about the state church of England is that you can't get, and for hundreds of years couldn't get, any preferment unless you were a member of the state church of England. And what did the state church teach? Well, you can go to the Book of Common Prayer and find the homily of obedience, which says flatly that everything, from the lowest insect to the highest king, is put in that place by God, and God doesn't want people to get out of their place, so that you have this perfectly organized divine system. Somewhere along the time of Mr. Darwin's boyhood, this idea that these placements were divinely ordained began to wear thin. And that jeopardized the social and economic structure of the most powerful country and countries on earth. So what came along was Mr. Darwin, who said exactly the same thing, only now it was scientific. Mm-hmm. Put big quotes around that. Remember, he was trained as a minister, and he said that biology had put everything in these precise places, and that's where they were supposed to stay. And then in his later book, Descent of Man, he said that if these things got out of their place and the good stuff crossbred with the bad stuff, evolution would march backward into the swirling mists of the dawnless past. I mean, that's pretty creepy. Now, I'll tell you something about Darwin that absolutely a tiny handful of people, no one else knows. Darwin was spectacularly wealthy. You won't find that in any textbook.
No, I didn't know that.
Spectacularly wealthy. He had the Wedgwood fortune, the China, and in those days, that was the high-tech, high art everyone had to have if they were going to be. Darwin's associates weren't the man in the street or the woman in the street. They were kings and dukes and earls. Darwin's family was in the inner circle of the British throne.
It sounds like he loved being there.
Well, imagine what he now offers not only to the crowned heads of England, but of Germany and Europe and as far away as Japan, George. What he offered was a perfect scientific justification to nail people into these boxes that we call classes, not by accident, it's justified. You're protecting the advancement of the human race. Now, obviously, you don't tell parents that, and you don't tell principals or superintendents that, but you can live with yourself. You can look in the mirror and say, well, we've got all the bad stuff locked up. And it's John Calvin, the great theologian in the 16th century, said, there's so many of these bad people, or the reprobate, he called them, that we're going to have to teach them to police one another because there's not enough of us to lock them in place so they won't cause trouble. Now, let me tell you something else that nobody seems to know about Mr. Darwin. First of all, he was the cousin of a guy named Thomas Malthus, who's taught in every freshman biology or sociology course in college, and in some high schools too. Malthus said that people were breeding faster than our power to feed them, and that there was no way ever that food increased arithmetically, he said, 1, 2, 3,
mm-hmm.
but people increased geometrically, 2, 4, 8, 16. So he said that the human race will put itself out of business unless some way is found to give these...
Exterminate us?
Well, he said that they should be given short, brutish lives, because that was actually a kindness, since there was no room for them, that if you shortened their life by working them to death, or stressing them to death, you're actually doing them a favor.
See,
now,
that's always been my theory of what these globalists want to do with all of us.
Oh my God! Look, your listeners should not believe that. Oh, they heard John Gatto say this. Just go to Malthus's essay on population. It's in every library in the United States. It's in every college in the United States. Just read it. He's quite a clear writer. He says there's no way out of this except working and stressing these people to death. Hey.
That's what they're doing to us.
But that was Darwin's. So Darwin, he was older. So Darwin grew up looking fondly on cousin Malthus, who was already being considered the friend of the establishment
mm-hmm.
across Europe. Now, Darwin's first cousin, slightly younger than himself, was a person called Francis Galton. Now, he's less known, but not unknown at all in college courses. Galton is considered widely to be, by psychometricians, people who measure the quality of mind, or at least pretend to, he's considered to be the single brightest human being who ever lived. This is Darwin's cousin. And what Galton did was to create a pseudoscience called eugenics,
oh my,
which taught how to keep the bad stuff in its place. And then he came to the United States a number of times and anointed various heads of the eugenic mission.
So he started this.
He not only started it, he invented the whole idea of reducing all of the growing up time to numbers, to formulae based on numbers, to lock people in their place with numbers, because politically then you can, and socially you can then justify, well, look at this kid's numbers, we can't let him go to college, et cetera, et cetera.
Amazing. Just amazing. And it started so long ago, yet it continues.
Well, it continues, and people should understand again, because I'm absolutely certain that there are people who are in on the continuation, but you don't need that to be true. All you need to do is set up a system of incentives and disincentives, and the thing will perpetuate itself forever. And, of course, that's what we've done through the licensing system. All of the various licenses, which extend down to bus drivers, mind you, those were the work of Andrew Carnegie and the Carnegie Foundation, of John D. Mm-hmm. Rockefeller, of the Rothschilds in Europe. The whole idea was to reserve these privileged occupations for people who played ball. And you could do that by setting up licensing commissions. And you would tell the public, this is to protect you, but it actually is to protect the system.
Interesting. Like lawyers, doctors, everything.
Let me prove that to your listeners. And you say, well, how can you prove it with just words? Well, let's take the standardized tests now. You hear people say that they're the core and the strength of a sane, rational system, and you've heard John Gatto say that they don't measure anything at all. But I'm about to prove to you, whoever you are, that you believe what I just said, and here's how I'll do that. Have you ever, in your entire life, gone to a barber and asked him what his grades or his standardized test scores were?
No.
How do you judge a barber? Well, you look in the mirror and you say, well, you dumb, et cetera,
blankety blank, yeah.
Have you ever gone to a doctor and asked him what his standardized test scores were or his grades? Let me tell you what you would have discovered if you had gone to the current president of the United States. You would have discovered what he told a Harvard audience about 3 years ago, that he was the best evidence that a C student could make good. So you'd find a C student, and in terms of standardized tests, you'd find somebody quite mediocre, 550 out of possible 800 on the verbals.
Mm-hmm.
However, rather than being someone who's here to run down George Bush, let me tell you something about his opposite number in the first election, Al Gore. Al Gore flunked out of college the first time, and at his second college, he graduated with C's and D's as his average. Let me tell you something about the legendary Senator Bill Bradley, who graduated from Princeton with no trouble.
Mm-hmm.
His standardized test scores were exactly at the median of Harlem kids. It was so low that it's embarrassing to say what it is, but not the lowest of all. The legendary senator from, I believe, Wisconsin or Minnesota, Paul Wellstone, who's recently
the late Paul. That's right.
All right, Mr. Wellstone graduated with a combined score on his SATs of 800. Now, in those days, the maximum was 2,400. And you don't have to be too good at math to figure out that he got a 33. I mean, really, I could go on.
What is this? What does this tell us, John?
This tells us that these tests measure nothing of value except it's not an opinion. There have been 80 or 90 studies that have cost millions of dollars attempting desperately to prove that these tests correlate with anything else. They correlate with exactly one thing, and that is your score on the next standardized test.
All right, stay
that
with us,
they correlate beautifully on.
Stay with us. We'll be back with John Taylor Gatto. We'll mention his book and this offer just for you. And guess what? Phone calls now, because you've been trying to get in for an hour. We'll do it when we come right back. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We'll take your phone calls this hour with our guest, John Taylor Gatode. John, before we get to the calls, give me your views on homeschooling. I wasn't really aware of it, except for a few years ago when people would call my program in St. Louis talking about how much they enjoyed homeschooling their kids. And I kept saying, what's that? But apparently they can do it. It's legal, right?
I'm overwhelmed with admiration, and it's not from a few contacts. I've done the keynote speech for 38 state homeschool conventions, some of them religious, some of them quite secular, and I am impressed beyond my power to communicate with the strength of the families that that undertaking provides, and also with the tremendous progress in intellectual and character development that's possible because you're freed from the strictures of systematic schooling. I'm going to be speaking for a homeschooling group in Spain in January, and I'm anxious to see the way they do it.
So you agree with it, though? You like it?
At first, it was a word to me. And most of the New York crowd would say, who would want to spend that much time with their kids? But it turns out to be just a dynamic and electric experience. Yeah, I'm in awe of what I've seen.
It is, I guess, legal to homeschool in most states, if not all states.
In every state.
Okay.
And if the local, this will be useful to your audience, if the local school district, as some do, gives you some trouble, you want to be a member of the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. It doesn't cost much. I think it's $100 a year, and I don't work for them, so this is an unpaid testimonial. But let me tell you, I've never met a school superintendent who wants to tackle those people. So they run good interference for you.
Who does the homeschooling primarily, the mother or the father?
Well, I would say the 25% of it. Now, this took me a long time to figure out. In 25% of the homeschooling families, both the mother and the father are working. So in the nature of an education, the kid has to do 90% of the work anyway. One of the things that are wrong with for schooling is we've reversed that formula, and 90% is done by the authority. Doesn't work for education. It's the grappling. So in 25% of the cases, apparently there are arrangements made with neighbors, with businesses, with uncles and aunts. And the other 75%, I would say, in most cases, it's the mother, although I've certainly met a sprinkling of fathers who, because of death or other reasons, do it. By and large, there's this experimental consciousness in homeschoolers.
Do some families bring in, let's say, a music teacher?
Oh, lots.
When either one doesn't understand.
To.
Okay, sure,
they
that's interesting.
They can draw on the entire community. And something to encourage your audience ought to be this. The most prestigious scientific job in the world, nothing's even close, is the head of the Human Genome Project, who happens to be a homeschooler. And get ready for this shock. Although he was raised in a non-religious household in Western Virginia, when he got to Harvard as a homeschooler, he decided to become a born-again Christian. He said the decision was, I'm quoting directly from the New York Times, intellectually inescapable, close quote. Now, I can tell you his colleagues are a little bit nervous about that, but look at that. This guy's raised on a remote sheep ranch in Western Virginia, and the curriculum he used was as follows. I would say 10% of the nation's homeschoolers use this curriculum. He studied whatever he felt like studying for as long as he felt like studying it, and then a balance, you know, two from column A and one from column B, and here's social studies. His name's Francis S. Collins, C-O-L-L-I-N-S, and he's the head of the Human Genome Project. So
that's remarkable.
I would hate in 20 years to have my kids, who both were National Merit Scholars, I would hate to have them in competition with this huge cohort of homeschooled kids that are now passing through that non-systematic system.
To the phones we go. Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, good morning.
Yes, sir.
I'm in the Chicago area, actually Highland Park, Illinois, Nathaniel. And when it comes to creationism, what I see is that it's a fusion of poor science and a poor understanding of Genesis, poor skills in the Semitic languages, and so on and so forth. The IPL just had on somebody who spoke about, was an expert in Semitic languages. Does that sound right, or was it a rerun?
That was a rerun, I believe, last week.
Yeah. And then you've had on a Stan from his website.
Stan Tenen.
Yeah, right.
Who, by the way, is going to be on again this week.
Pardon me?
He's going to be on again this week, as a matter of fact.
Oh, great. Because both of them are basically on target, but, you know. Well, anyway, so that's why I say that a lot of people can get a little off when it comes to Genesis. And how creationism is a fusion is, they take neo-Darwinism, like survival of the fittest, which is the most difficult problem Darwinism because it's not scientific. It's circular. What is fit if it survives? What survives because it's fit? And it's not me necessarily saying this. You can Arthur Koestler, quite a long time ago, who is totally secular and open to all sorts of ideas. I mean, he wrote about revisiting Darwinism, neo-Darwinism, because it's crumbling.
Well, John, we got your views on Darwinism, but we didn't really get your thoughts on the creationism part.
Well, the first thing I'd like to say is that all historical theories of science, whether evolution or Big Bang, are a form of art. They're not science at all because they, in their nature, cannot stand the burden of proof. Now, I'm not arguing for or against the theory of evolution. I'm saying that it will forever remain a theory. It's impossible to be proved. And if you take the Big Bang, I just saw an obit in the New York Times of some major scientist who had lived his life demonstrating mathematically that the Big Bang theory was nonsense, and he was on the MIT faculty there. But what I think what we need to know is that all these battles back and forth are really political battles or philosophical battles or aesthetic battles. If you want to believe that the fittest survive, you want to believe what John Calvin said, that only a few are elected by the Lord, and that all the rest, regardless of how good their lives they lead are condemned. That's, of course, the theory of evolution when it's reduced to political terms. Whether evolution or creationism, wouldn't you agree, George, that every one of us who uses our mind has an interest in where this all came from?
That's true. I agree with that.
And so to have a range of, colors on the palette strikes me as exactly what an artist would want. But to call any of these historical theories science is to not understand what science is.
Next up, let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on with John Taylor Gatto. Hi there.
Hello. I have a question for John. First let me preface it by saying this. The statistic is that in inner city big public school systems, the non-graduation rate currently and for probably approximately the last 10 years has been at least 50% of the student enrollment never will graduate, even if they do attain ninth grade level. I was wondering if when the schools were segregated back in the 60s before this integration came along, were their non-graduation rates the same, comparable, when they're segregated schools at that time? And if so, doesn't that say that our integrated school system has miserably failed them because their graduating level isn't any better?
Well, we'll agree that the schools have miserably failed them. I would have to dispute your unconscious connection of a graduation rate with any success in the development of either your mind or your character. But I want to say one further thing that ought to open up the debate for both of us. If you were in a business, a public business like schooling, and you wanted more money and more status, more prestige and more attention, would that come to you from success or failure? And I think it only takes a little reflection to realize that failure is a necessity for this huge institution, because only failure can lead to the statement that if we had more money, we would succeed better. And I've traced this back to the very beginning of institutional schooling. The calls for money as the answer to failure. Well, failure we're going to have with us because nobody cares. You don't look at things that succeed. I mean, if it isn't broken, don't fix it, right? The real trouble with school reform, and I mean this quite literally, is that it would cost so little, so much less than we're currently spending on schools, that nobody involved in schooling could allow it to happen.
Scott from Charlotte, North Carolina, writes with a very interesting question for you. Homeschooling, how do they get scholarships and the like?
Oh, my. Okay. I'm gonna give you all out there, and I know there are millions of you, an assignment. You want your librarian to pick up a book from the interlibrary system called Trouble in Paradise by David and Mickey Colfax, C-O-L-F-A-X. They live in Northern California. They homeschooled their four sons on a hard clay mountaintop where they had to haul water for most of the kids' growing up time, and they lived in a car for the first year they were out there, and three of their four sons got full tuition scholarships to Harvard. The fourth son declined to ask for one because he was, at the age of 18, a nationally famous goat breeder, and he said, I don't have time to waste in college. And the whole account of how it's done, it's probably the best I've ever read, although I've read a bunch of good ones. But David Colfax's, and Mickey, I'm sorry, I don't mean to offend you if you're listening, both of them, raised the four sons on what amounts to a poverty budget and three of the four full tuition scholarships at Harvard.
Fantastic. So there is hope.
There's a lot of hope. If you throw a bucket of cold water over your head and say, I'm going to think this through for myself, I'd say in the first couple of months, you'll suddenly begin to see what reality looks like, and in this case, reality in education, and you'll find that you have a lot of the resources you need, and you'll find that it's amazingly exciting to improvise the other resources.
Okay, let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Nori. Hello.
Hello.
I want to say what's up to the Springs. I'm glad that they're finally on over there. And we got to get Boulder on now, too, huh? Hello?
Hello. What are you saying? I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, you said that you're on in the Springs now, the Colorado Springs.
No, I was talking about some people who were calling from Colorado Springs. Yes, we're always out there. But go ahead with your question. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. My bad. Mr. Gatto, I just wanted to ask you two things. I've been thinking about this for a long time, and I just always kind of wanted to ask somebody. As far as Darwin's theory is concerned, do you think that divine intervention kind of proves Darwin's theory false or no? As far as, like, say somebody did something stupid and they were about to die, but something happened so to save their life, like divine intervention, wouldn't that, like, disprove Darwin's theory?
Well, I think the difficulty in using that as an argument with other people are that it seems to come from your particular assessment of a situation, whether it was, I mean, I find nothing wrong with having a personal religion. It's just difficult to argue to your fellow citizens that school ought to be this way or that way, or we have to teach this or that on that basis. And I'm not really competent to lecture an audience on what they ought to believe, although I have strong beliefs myself.
But you do believe, though, that Darwin's theories were motivated by the kinds of people he associated with.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. What he found was a miraculous way to turn theories of divine intervention that had been used as the stabilizing principle in governments for forever. He found a way to turn those into a scientific argument. There's a perfect identity between Darwin's argument and Calvin's argument. And really, it's fascinating. And the fact that Darwin was trained as an Anglican minister makes it even more fascinating.
John's book, by the way, the very new book he's got, is called The Underground History of American Education. He will knock $5 off that for you if you mention that you are a Coast to Coast AM listener. Also, he will throw in a free cassette of his speech on the scientific management of children. Couple ways for you to order this book and take advantage of the deal. And, of course, his website, those of you who are computer savvy, johntaylorgatto.com, and I'll spell that for you. It's just John, then Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R, and then his last name, Gatto, Taylor Gatto, G-A-T-T-O, johntaylorgatto.com. Or you can fax him the order at 212-529-3555. That's 212-529-3555. And with that faxed order, of course, all the information that you normally put down when you fill out a credit card, that's the credit card number, your name, your address, your phone number, and the expiration date. You got to have all that in there, and then he'll be able to get you the book. But mention Coast to Coast AM, and you'll get the free cassette to the speech. If you like what he's saying now, you'll love that. And then you'll get $5 off the book, and every penny counts. I'll be back in a moment. We'll continue to take final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with your phone calls. John, a couple people are sending me messages. They want to make sure they looked for the book, Trouble in Paradise. They couldn't find it, but they did find Hard Times in Paradise.
All right, Hard Times in Paradise.
Is that it?
You can write that off to an aging mind. But, yes, Hard Times in Paradise, and you will absolutely love what you read.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's pick it up by going west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello, George. How you doing?
Fine.
This is Bill calling from Tucson, Arizona.
Sure, Bill.
I wanted to tell you I really appreciate having a guest such as an intellectual, truthful, pure, logical man as Mr. Gatto. Mr. Gatto, I deeply appreciate your program tonight.
Thank you, Bill.
I can't help but recall what Galileo went through when he broke outside of the box of thinking. Basically blasted the teachings of Copernicus, and they basically branded him as a heretic almost to the point of burning him to the stake. And I would say to those listening tonight, as a person who has done this, what you've been talking about, the hardest thing in the world is to sit down in a quiet moment and say to yourself that the only way that you can find absolute truth is to convince yourself that you must go back and unlearn all that you have been taught.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, Bill.
You have to be willing to look at yourself in the mirror and deny that maybe you have been wrong about many things in your life. And I think that's the hardest thing for people to do because they're afraid that they're going to rock the boat and maybe even disappoint themselves. Would you agree with that?
I would absolutely agree with it, and I would remind everybody listening that there has never in the history of the world been a major philosopher who didn't say, know thyself. Know yourself is the secret. Not know what you're supposed to know that the boss told you. Know yourself. I just heard before the show came on from a professional football critic that the great teams study the film to see what the individual players' tendencies are, and then what they try to do is change those tendencies because they know the opposite team is studying the film to see what your habits are. Think of schools as a great conditioning mechanism to inculcate habits in you that are useful to the managers of business or society or whatever. And you need to be yourself and break those habits.
Great. Thanks, Bill. Appreciate your phone call and being on Coast to Coast. First time caller line. You're up. Hi there.
Yes. My name is Roger.
Hi, Roger.
I'm calling from in Ohio. I'm a truck driver. And I wanted to ask Mr. Gatto, boy, it sure is great to be on with y'all. I really been listening to y'all since Art Bell, and I think you're doing a great job, Joy.
Thank you.
But, Mr. Gatto, my son suffers from ADHD, and I was wondering the focus that he has trouble with. Is that a learned thing that the going through school is, you know, they teach you not to focus on, I guess, is what I'm getting at. Is
I think I understand, Roger. Of course, I only had 30 years experience with what's called ADHD, so I don't know everything, but in my experience, the ADHD that's identified by the school is very, very profitable to the school. And whether it exists or not in reality, or is just a set of learned habits, I would come down on it's a set of learned habits that can be unlearned, but not unlearned if you follow the instructions of the medical staff that associates itself with schooling. It's big business to dope kids up with Ritalin, for example. 93% of all the Ritalin used on planet Earth is used in the United States. So it's an instant fortune for drug companies. Similarly, ADHD is the heart of a jobs project. We don't find a record of it historically, either in this country or in any other country. It's an invention of recent times, and I think that a lot of parents have been driven sick by pseudo-medical advice.
Yeah, I always thought my tendencies when I was growing up, my mom kept me on a leash because when I was young, I would run off. I didn't care, you know, where I was, but she had to keep me, or my five brothers would run off with me. But they wouldn't leave as long as I was there, but if I'd leave, so what it would be like is keeping them from being a leader.
Yes, yes. Incidentally, this is not apropos what you said, but I've found over the course of my life that truck drivers, especially long-distance truck drivers, are among the wisest people on Earth. My closest friend is a long-distance 52 years old, said, well, it's silly that I give all this money to some of us. I'll just set up a long-distance trucking company, and now he's the next March, and I think he might.
We got him up there right at the end. We lost him. We're going to bring back on. I guess I should have brought the mature apple. Huh? Let's go to our.
Hello?
Yeah, welcome to the show.
Oh, hi, George. It's Stuart calling. Has John disappeared?
Nope, we got him back.
Okay.
There you are, John. The wonders of broadcasting. We've got you.
Hello, Stuart. Hello, John.
Where are you from?
Oh, I'm on Maui in Hawaii.
Oh, wow.
Yes, wow.
Yeah, the Maui Times. He's a friend of mine, the publisher.
Wonderful. Well, the question I had, or actually I wonder if you'd be willing to give us a brief dissertation on your view of the influence that the Hegelian dialectic has had upon the educational, or if you like, schooling system in the United States, as well as our system of jurisprudence.
Oh, absolutely. But I must say that I want to separate Hegel and the dialectic. Aristotle, the dialectic, for those of you who are not up on philosophy, is a method and a style of thinking. And if you read Aristotle's Politics, you'll find that that wise man a long time ago said that people who can't think dialectically aren't really human beings. They're sort of incomplete things. Anyway, Hegel comes along a couple of hundred years ago at the University of Berlin in Prussia, and he gives the managerial classes, let me call them, Planet Earth, a way to control history. How about that? And furthermore, people like J.P. Morgan go over there and study Hegel's system. Hegel says if you can provoke crisis, you know, you create a crisis. I'm not suggesting this happened, but let's say that you make sure that two skyscrapers get knocked down by airplanes. Then under the guise of this provoked crisis, you can move history in radical directions. And your excuse is this crisis. We all know, I think, that Hitler did this with the burning of the Reichstag back in the 1930s, and then that was an excuse to go after the inferior. There are an awful lot of people, and they're not nuts, who believe that the attack on Pearl Harbor was deliberately provoked by the Roosevelt administration. The way they did it was to cut off oil going to Japan in order to cause the Second World War, which was a way to get out of the Depression, and it certainly worked that way. So the Hegelian dialectic is a sinister thing, but let me tell you this. There's not a major university in this country that doesn't reserve the study of the Hegelian dialectic for its very, very finest students, the ones who are on the fast track. And I think that you and I and everyone better be aware of this so that we can judge historical events in our own life as to whether they're created crises or real crises.
John, you think exactly down the lines of all of us here at Coast to Coast. It's refreshing. If we were to change this system, this educational system, well, how would we start? What would we do?
Well, that's a wonderful question, because there are already in existence several asystematic systems that work so beautifully. I'll tell you about a few of them. We've already talked about one of them that's probably too big and sprawling to get a fix on, called homeschooling. But let me talk of two very the much narrower undertakings, one by the Old Order Amish, who exist in a few states like central Pennsylvania and Wisconsin with their own kids. I spoke at an Amish convention 5 or 6 years ago, and one Amish said to me, we could build a rocket to the moon if we didn't think it was damn nonsense to do that. He said, we can do anything, and they can. It's fascinating. Johns Hopkins University, which is no slouch where universities go, has studied the Amish for about 30 years, and it says they are the wealthiest coherent group in the United States. And their biggest problem is that they already have, by their own lights, perfect lives, and so what are they going to do with all this money they make? It gets in the way. I've mentioned the Amish and the fact that they have virtually no divorce, no drug use, that every Amish kid is raised to have an independent livelihood. Think about that for a moment, because that really is the key. The United States dazzled the world right up to the Civil War because we raised every kid to have an independent livelihood. Now, that didn't mean that 20 or 30 of them didn't throw together and have an enterprise going, but people who had to work for a living, like the truck driver who just caught it, were trained to put some money aside and think about having an independent living when they assembled a small stake. The criticism I've gotten from some people when I say that is, well, the Amish are held together by this powerful religious glue, and that's true. So now let me offer you a totally non-religious group in the northwest corner of Spain called the Mondragon Cooperative. Let me spell that. M-O-N-D-R-A-G-O-N. They're almost exactly the size of the Amish in the United States, except they're non-religious, actively non-religious. They have a system among their own children of raising every kid to have an independent livelihood. And through all the 20th century, when Europe was in depression or recession, the economy in this area of Spain was always booming. I went there last year, and it's just dazzling. They don't raise anybody to be an employee. Now, would that mean the end of giant corporations? Certainly, as we know it, it would mean the end of that. It's a different kind of economy, but it's quite prosperous.
All right, let's go to our East of the Rockies. Thank you, John, for that. East of the Rockies, go ahead. You're on Coast to Coast.
Hi, this is Kathy in Roswell, Georgia.
All right, Kathy.
Hi, John and George. I just wanted to say that when my kids were in school, they had a difficult time just making attendance, and most of the time they didn't have very good attendance. And people were very upset with me that, don't you want them to get an education? But the schools seemed to want them to love conformity, and I wanted them to love to learn, and they were destroying their love, their natural, basic love of learning. And I said, if they love to learn, they will get an education, you know? Yes. And I don't leave it to the public schools to educate them. And they've done very well. But the thing is, if they could, when the schools make learning miserable and tedious and a negative experience, you don't have to dumb people down. They'll dumb themselves down.
That's what John Calvin said. They'll police themselves.
Yeah.
And by dumbing themselves down, by making themselves ignorant and crude and ill-mannered, all manner of things. Schools can't provide an education, period. Schools can school. Now, schooling is, in a limited sense, useful in many cases. You want to take a rifle apart and put it back together blindfolded, you want to be well-schooled. But in order to develop good judgment and personal goals and philosophies and all the important things in a life, you have to have an education. And the more you're schooled, the less you're able to do that. I think you did the right thing. I mean, compulsory attendance is itself a horror. That should make anyone suspicious that the principle of independent access is broken by the laws of schooling, so that a kid can't discover apprenticeships for himself or herself, you know, and follow their own star. If you read the obituaries, and my goodness, I urge all of you to read the obituaries in some major newspaper and in magazines, they'll show you the arc of successful lives. And over again, you'll see that the principles that you think, well, that you've been taught, are the right principles, were violated by everybody who's successful.
Well, like the bell in a school that ends the class, John, we're out of time. I want to thank you for a very enlightening educational night.
Oh, I had a lot of fun doing this, and people mention Coast to Coast, and we'll cut you the break on the book, and we'll give you the free cassette. But mention Coast to Coast, or we can't do it.
Great, thanks, John. Appreciate it.
Bye now.
His website linked up with his name right there on coasttocoastam.com. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, back in the City of Angels. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, everyone, be safe.